Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com.
Today's episode is being featured on Podbean's crowd support service. If you like what I do here, please consider supporting the show by visiting patron.podbean.com/writerwriterpantsonfire. For a dollar a month, you'll get a thank you from me, Mindy McGinnis, on the blog or through one of my social media accounts. For $5, you get a shout out on a podcast episode. And for 10, you can post questions or suggest topics for the end of the month guest-free show. $20 will get you a Google chat with myself, or if you're a writer looking to advertise your book, a freelance editor or copy editor who would like to air your services to the aspiring writers who listen in here, check out the patron crowdfunding services offered through Podbean, again at patron.podbean.com/writerwriterpantsonfire. Today's guest is middle grade author Tara Dehrman, whose debut novel, All Four Stars, about an 11-year-old restaurant critic moonlighting for New York's biggest newspaper, was published in 2014, followed by The Stars of Summer and Stars So Sweet in 2015 and 2016. A new standalone middle grade novel, The Great Hibernation, will hit the shelves on September 12th. Tara joined me to talk about her querying and publishing journey and how a contest helped her gain an invitation to query a closed agency and land her agent. So I want to ask you about your querying journey and the process of finding an agent. Usually we talk about this for quite a long period of time because this podcast is for aspiring writers. And I think that is the first hurdle and in some ways the most challenging, especially when you're first starting. So tell us about how you got your agent and the querying process and maybe even a little bit about your background. Did you have any contacts in publishing? Was this something you just decided you wanted to do and you jumped in?
It's funny you ask if I had any contacts in publishing because over the years, I had met two different literary agents and both had said, you know, when you're finished with your first book, send it my way. And I was all excited to have a couple of contacts. And it took me so long to actually finish writing my first book that both of those agents had left agenting by the time I was ready to query. So I had no contacts by then. I was just on the same page as anybody else. What I did was I sent out queries and I also entered online contests where agents would be judging first pages or query letters or both. So I had some requests from those contests. I look back at my numbers today, actually, and I believe I had about 6 requests from contests. Mm-hmm. And I sent out about 35 queries. And I had some requests for manuscripts from those as well. That took about 4 months, I think, from when I started querying to when I got my first offer. And I got my first offer from a contest. Having that one offer then, of course, spurred a lot of the agents to actually go and read the submission that I had sent them. Because, you know, a lot of agents are so busy, they probably won't start reading unless they're nudged with either some other agent offering you representation or maybe an editor showing interest mm-hmm. in your book. So I ended up with 5 offers in the end. So I had wow. quite a lot of different agents to choose from. And luckily for me, they were all very different. So it was kind of easy to put them into categories and figure out who was going to be the right fit for me. There were some agents who represented only children's or primarily children's books. And there were some who represented adults and children's. So when I decided I wanted someone focused on children's, that narrowed it down. Some agents seemed to have more of a commercial focus and some had more of a literary focus. Some were more editorial and some were not editorial at all. It was kind of like that Goldilocks situation where you had to find the one who was just right mm-hmm. for you. And for me, that was Amy Joan Peckett at the Aaron Murphy Literary Agency. And she's still my agent. So I'm one of those rare authors who's still with her first agent. I would say that among all of the writers I know, that's probably not a very common situation anymore. Usually people are in their second or third after a few years.
Yes, it's very true. I also am with my first agent and still very happy. But mm-hmm. most of my friends, if not all, have definitely switched agents, focuses shift, or even agents go to different agencies.
Right.
And sometimes the authors are left behind or they don't want to switch yeah. agencies. I've seen that happen too.
And part of it deciding between five different offers was instinct as well. People always say talk to them on the phone, and I had conversations with the first four agents who offered, and then the fifth offer came in really late in the game when I had already pretty much made up my mind. And just something struck me as a little flakier about this agent that, you know, she hadn't gotten her act together to read the manuscript within my deadline, and then she really wanted to talk, and it was very last minute. I felt terrible because she had taken the time to read it, but I had made my decision, and I just didn't think I was going to change my mind. So I told her I wasn't interested in having a conversation at that point. And within a year, she had left agenting. So I don't think it was me that caused her to leave agenting, but I think I was smart to go with my instinct there. Something said her heart wasn't really in it as much as the other four who are all still active agents, you know, 6 years later.
Maybe aspiring writers don't always realize that agents fluctuate greatly.
Yeah.
Agents come into and leave the game all the time. And if you are with a beginning agent, a new agent can be a wonderful thing because they're hungry and they're looking for clients and they are actively reading their slush, trying to find a way to build up their client list. But they have to get established too. They have to make a living and they have to bust their butts in order to make a dime. And sometimes it's just not a viable option for them. When I signed with my agent is Adrian Ranta. Mm-hmm. When I signed with her, she only had one YA sale. And I, too, had another offer from an agent who was more established.
Right.
She also had read the manuscript basically the night before, emailed and said, I want to have a conversation. And I was like, okay, cool. And she was really nice and really well established. And it was a hard decision because I really felt like I had connected with Adrian, but she was new and she had one sale. And this agent had had like 30 sales that month. It was insane.
That's a really hard decision. I was lucky. Also, one thing that I did before making my final decision was I got a subscription for the month to Publishers Marketplace so that I could look at each agent's record, you know, over the last 2 years and see how many deals they were making, which isn't foolproof because not everyone reports all of their deals, but most of them do, I think. So I was able to kind of look at the stats, which I really hadn't considered so much when I was looking at everything else.
Right.
And luckily, the agent I liked the best and clicked with the most also had the best sales record. So that kind of sealed the deal for me. I could definitely see how it would be really hard to be in your situation where you're deciding between someone who's young and hungry and connects really well with your work and somebody who's more established but might not have as much time for you. I've seen friends with some of these really big deal agents, and sometimes they're a little bit busy handling the careers of their mega bestsellers and are not so devoted to their newer clients.
Yes. And for me, when I had a conversation with Adrian, she connected with the book. She connected with me. We were talking about Crime and Punishment. And then with this other agent who is still agenting and is very well known and is really a wonderful agent. But she's more in the romance category. And I simply don't write that. So I knew that Adrian was going to be a better fit for me in the long run and for the career as well. The one sale, honestly, it was scary to me. But at the same time, I was like, okay, I'm going to take that risk because I think she's the better fit. So like you were saying, with instinct is what I went with, and it was the right choice.
That's great. And clearly, you know, it hasn't hurt your career because now she has lots of sales, many of which are yours, right?
Yes, she's doing well.
But to go back to the idea of not always keeping the same agent, if you make the wrong choice up front, if you have multiple offers, well, if it doesn't work out after a year or two, maybe you'll end up going back to somebody else who liked your work in the past, or you'll find somebody new who's a better fit. So I think aspiring writers shouldn't feel the need to stay in one agent relationship if it's not working out for them. I've been with one agent my whole career, but my editor left, my editor for my middle grade series, the Gladys Gatsby books. After the third book, she left publishing. Someone's always going to make some kind of switch and leave you behind somewhere.
So I want to talk a little bit about the contests that you utilize to help you put your work in front of agents, because I also did contests. I had some requests off of them. I ended up getting my agent off of a cold query, but I know lots of people that have had luck with contests, and I actually am a mentor for Pitch Wars now, and so I know the value of contests for aspiring writers. I was curious about which ones you used and if they are still around.
So this was 2011 when I was doing the contest and query game. And Miss Snark's First Victim, which is a blog that is definitely still around, I did two different contests with her. She used to do a monthly secret agent contest, which I think she might still do from time to time, but not as often anymore. And that was a contest where you submitted a first page, and she just had like a bot that randomly chose from everybody who wanted to submit that month. So maybe you would get it and maybe you wouldn't. An agent would go through and read all the entries and leave comments on all of them and then pick some winners. And if you were one of the winners, I think they would request either, you know, a partial or a full manuscript to read. I got into that one month. The secret agent named me as one of the runners up, I think. So she requested some pages, but then also my current agent, Amy Joan Paquette. So she's with Aaron Murphy Literary Agency, and they're not open to queries, but sometimes they will go and read stuff in these online contests. And if they see something that intrigues them, they'll ask you to query them, and then you have your invitation. So that's what happened there. She liked what she read, and she asked me to query her. I got to query two agents out of that contest. And actually, the one who was the judge, I don't think she ever responded to me, but Joan really liked what she read, luckily. So that was how I ended up with her. And then later on, I also entered another contest through Miss Snark's First Victim, which was their agent auction, which she would do at the end of the year. And I think that one's changed a little bit, but she might still be doing it in some form.
Yes, I was involved in the Baker's Dozen with her.
Yeah, that's what it was called.
I didn't get anywhere with it simply because what I was writing at the time, this was back in like 2009, what I was writing at the time had, elements of urban fantasy, and that had died on the vine. And so that was what was stopping me. But the contest itself was amazing. I definitely suggest any contest. It's just a wonderful way to put yourself out there and get your stuff in front of people. And
that one was really nice because there were so many agents looking at it at once and kind of leaving their requests in real time. It was a big boost for me to see that multiple agents were interested, and that atmosphere of them having to compete against each other for like the highest bid to get your manuscript. They're not bidding money, they're bidding pages, you know, the number of pages that they're willing to read. And also then they have a time limit. The winning agent gets 1 week to read your manuscript and decide if they want to make an offer or not before the other agents are allowed to enter the fray. So I actually got my first offer from the agent who won my manuscript in that auction. And that was what then allowed me to go back to anybody else who had a partial and say, okay, I have an offer. Do you want to read the rest? So that was terrific. And I also entered one more contest, which was at Krista Van Dozier's blog. It was called An Agent's Inbox. And I think she still occasionally does that as well. So that one was where you would do your query and first page, I believe. And each month an agent would come and read all of them and leave comments about whether she would request it and why or why not. And the agent who judged that one didn't send me a request, but she had some interesting feedback. I also connected with other writers through those contests because, you know, you read all of the other entries and get to see who else is out there and who else is querying. And so many of my writer friends now who are agented and published, I first found their work through some of these contests. It's a great way to connect with other writers. I found a critique partner through Miss Snark's First Victims, and we're still trading work all these years later, and she's about to sign her first book deal. So it's very exciting.
I met my critique partners on Agent Query Connect. All of us were starting out at the same time, and we all actually sold in within 2 years of each other, and we're all still writing. And yes, I remember doing Baker's Dozen along with some of my critique partners, and we would just be sitting there refreshing our screens.
Yep.
Just refresh, refresh, refresh. Oh my gosh, it was addicting.
Starting out, getting into the industry, that was just a great way to connect with other writers as well as agents and editors. Start getting my toes into that community that would then later become so important, because those writers who are starting out at the same time as you, you know, if one of them ends up being a big bestseller or winning a big award and they're your critique partner, like, hey, you can hit them up for a great blurb on your next book. You can do events with them, or maybe you'll be the big bestseller and everyone will be coming to you.
You never know. Having those connections is priceless. Yeah.
Coming up, how to navigate social media when your target audience may not be there, the best way to use an email list, and the question of who you write for when you write middle grade, the kids or the gatekeepers.
You write middle grade. How do you balance between writing the story for your target audience while also keeping in mind the content threshold in terms of the gatekeepers, such as parents, librarians, and teachers?
That's a great question. And certainly when I started out and knew nothing about publishing, I was really just writing for me, you know, writing the kind of story that I thought I would have enjoyed as a younger reader, but that also I still enjoyed as an adult. And that's still really the main thing that I try to do. And one of my favorite bits of feedback that I sometimes get is when a kid will write to me or a parent will write to me and say that they've been reading one of my books together and that the adults are enjoying it just as much as the kids are. I do humor, but I try to include the kind of humor that works on many different levels. And you spend so long writing a novel, even when it's a novel for kids, which is shorter than, you know, an adult literary novel. You have to write something that you yourself are going to enjoy the elements of, a story that you're going to enjoy spending time working on, spending time in that world, because you're going to have to read it so many times and rewrite it so many times. You had better have characters that you love and a world that you enjoy spending time in. I'm still the target audience, I would say, for at least those early drafts. And luckily, I have editors at big companies who know the market and can maybe advise me if there's something that might need adjusting or that I need to think about that I haven't thought about yet. I don't think too much about the gatekeepers as I'm writing my stories. I'm about to release my fourth book, so I know the world of middle grade readers a little bit more, and I've connected with a lot more librarians. I've been lucky to have my first book on a few state lists, so that's been terrific, and a lot of librarians and teachers have reached out to me. I do school visits. I Skype with different groups of students. So now I do understand a little bit more what kind of things they're looking for and what kind of things they like. Something that has been nice for my books is that I've seen them on lists, and I've had people comment to me that I don't really write sad books. Of course, the new book I'm writing now is totally sad, but so far the books I've published have been mostly humorous, lots of action and adventure, appropriate for readers who maybe are not ready for a very heavy book for whatever reason. They might be at some point in their lives where they've been through something difficult, or they just don't like scary books. When I was a young reader, I didn't enjoy scary reads either. So there was a Barnes & Noble list that came out last year, 10 middle grade books that are not remotely sad or scary. Mm-hmm. And my book was on that list. And I was like, yay, because sometimes there are kids who that's exactly the kind of book that they need. So it's nice that my books can fill that niche when there is a lot of beautifully written literary middle grade out there, but that also has a lot of sadness in it or tragedy that maybe not every reader is ready for in every situation. So I'm glad to be able to fill a hole mm-hmm. for those readers who need something that's a little lighter and a little more fun.
I think that's wonderful. I don't have to worry about that as much because I write YA.
Yeah.
It's a very different world. And I do write dark, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I write specifically for my audience. I don't worry about the gatekeepers. Probably should worry about it a little bit more because they're not entirely free of parental oversight. But for the most part, YA librarians, they're very aware of the fact that their readers are looking for content that relates to them. And yeah. most YA librarians aren't looking to protect their readership. Yeah. Most of them are just trying to find something that they can relate to. And unfortunately, right now, it's really dark things are what the kids are experiencing and they're looking for, and their daily lives can be rough. And so that's what I write. And I have yet to have anyone really upbraid, except for my mother, really upbraid me for content. My own mother, definitely. But other than that, I have had the most positive, overwhelming support for the book that has the most content in it.
Yeah.
The Female of the Species is the one that everyone wants to talk to me about. Librarians, teachers, parents. And no one ever says, maybe you could lay off the sex. And I'm like, yeah. Okay, cool. Like, everyone seems to, for the most part, be open to the content that I provide. But of course, in a middle grade, it's a completely, completely different universe.
First of all, I agree completely about The Female of the Species. And I'm so glad that so many people are connecting with it, 'cause I adore that book. Yeah, it is interesting. I've had a little bit of pushback. In my third book in the All Four Stars series, I have a minor character who admits to having a crush on another girl. So mm-hmm. there's a same-sex crush. Nothing develops beyond that. And it's interesting because in the second book, I have a kiss between a boy and a girl. And I remember when that got published and I thought, oh, well, I'm going to hear from the angry grandparents now who think that, you know, 12-year-olds shouldn't be kissing. And I've never gotten a single email or letter or comment about that content. I've gotten some about this crush where it's just an unrequited crush. There's one scene about it. I feel it's such a minor part of the book, but at the same time, very true to this character's arc over the three books. And I really wanted it in there. And luckily my publisher was cool with that and supportive about it. And I haven't gotten a lot of pushback, honestly. You know, I thought maybe there would be more. But at the same time, when you're talking about a third book in a middle grade series, I just feel like not that many people are reading it unless they're already fans of the first two. Or the kids are reading it, but it's not being on school lists. So it has been interesting for me in terms of dealing with gatekeepers in that context. But like I said, it's only really a very small handful of people who've reached out. And I always try to write back to those people, explain a little bit about what I'm trying to do, what I'm not trying to do, and also maybe gently remind them that gay marriage is the law of the land. I'm not really pushing an agenda here. It's more about just being realistic with what life is like these days for young people and for us all as Americans. It's very interesting, you know, how much also is different regionally. I grew up in New York, definitely a much more liberal state than the past few that I've lived in. Now I'm here in Texas, though in a very liberal city in Austin. So again, I'm kind of in a bit of a bubble. It's been interesting talking to teachers and librarians and parents from different parts of the country and seeing there are certainly some areas where that kind of content is praised and some areas where it's still quite controversial.
You know, I'm always surprised with my first book, with Not a Drop to Drink. I have people asking if there is sex, and there's not. There's not even, there's hardly kissing because people don't have time for that. And I have parents and grandparents ask me about this because I tell them it's appropriate for 13 and up, and I think that's accurate. So I have parents and grandparents asking me, is there sex? And I was like, no, there's absolutely not. There's a kissing maybe once or twice. They don't even ask it about violence, and I offer lots of violence. There's gun violence, but it opens with a 9-year-old shooting someone from the roof of a house, right? And I explained this, that there is realistic gun violence in the book a million times over, and they're like, oh, that's fine, as long as there's no sex.
Yeah, it's such a double standard. I've seen there's no real violence in my books because they're about young restaurant critics. So other than a few sharp Japanese knives here and there, like nothing really dangerous being wielded by anyone. But yeah, I've seen that with other books and movies. And when people talk about content and ask me for recommendations, occasionally I'll recommend like a middle grade murder mystery or something. And they're like, oh, my kid's not okay with anyone dying. And I'm like, oh, it's really done in a very amusing way. And they're like, no.
Right.
I'm like, okay, at least you know that. And you acknowledge that content out there that could be seen as objectionable, that's not just sexual.
I always am stunned by the reactions that I get on the violence and even the very small amount, and I do mean minuscule, pushback that I have had on Female of the Species has been the sex. And, you know, someone is burned alive in that book.
It's so interesting to me to hear because, like, I guess I remember that that there's sexual stuff happening between the characters, but it's certainly the violence that stands out to me more. But none of it would be any reason I wouldn't recommend it to a teenager, because I just think that's a book that they should all be reading. So
thank you. Let's talk more about your target audience. So they're not necessarily on social media. What would you say is your highest age range?
Probably 13 is the top end. 7 to 13 probably is the large range.
So they may not necessarily be on social media.
Right.
So when you're on social media, who are you targeting with your social media presence?
Great question. So when I started out, I remember I joined Twitter right when I was entering those contests that we were talking about. And what I would do there is just follow agents I was interested in or editors I was interested in and connect with my fellow writers who I was meeting through these contests and stuff like that. Still, definitely with Twitter, I think the people that I'm talking to there when I bother to tweet, which isn't all that much anymore, are my colleagues, my fellow writers, and, you know, people in the industry. So that's who I expect would be looking at my tweets. Those are the people who I'm having conversations with there. So for me, Twitter is more about being in a professional community with my peers. I have a Facebook author page, and I definitely have some parents and librarians who are following me there, in addition to, you know, friends and fellow authors and stuff. And then on Instagram, which is my newest, although I've been on it for a few years now, that's the one place where I do get some young followers. Like after I do an event at a school or something like that, I sometimes do get teenagers who are following me. I don't follow them back. Usually their accounts are locked anyway, which I think is probably a good idea if you're that young and you're posting photos. So I wouldn't expect them to want me to follow them back, but they follow me there. You're right. Mostly it's not the young readers themselves who I'm talking to through my posts on the social media accounts, but it's a mix of peers and some librarians and teachers and parents and readers. I just try to post things about if I have upcoming events, if I have a new book coming out, cover reveal, giveaway, contest, things like that, that would be of interest to anybody who likes to read my books or who has a young reader in their lives who might like to read my books. I save my political rants and family pictures for my private Facebook page that's just among friends.
So how do you use Instagram? Because it's something that I use it and I actually have a decent following. I'm not good about using it consistently, and I'm still looking for the best way for an author to use Instagram, because I don't post pictures of my home or anything like that.
I don't post pictures of my kid, rarely my husband, occasionally myself. But luckily, because my first middle grade series, my first three books are about a young restaurant critic, and I like to cook and eat, I just post a lot of pictures of food. And that's kind of what my audience is looking for anyway, because I have a lot of foodies who are fans of my books, whether they're adults or younger readers. So for me, it's pretty easy. I kind of have this one brand. It's pretty much food and travel and other books. I often post pictures of what I'm reading. If I get advanced copies of friends' books and stuff and I want to give them a little boost or I'm really enjoying something, I'll even post pictures of a paragraph or a sentence that I really like from a book that I'm reading. I'll just take a picture of it and do a little highlighting or something and mention that. So yeah, those are my three things: food, travel, and books. And I just kind of rotate between the three of them. And I find that I usually have content to post, not every day, but pretty often.
That's really smart. I have mostly it's books and cats because I have 7 cats. Sometimes I have 8. It kind of depends on whether or not one of them is home, because she does what she wants. But that's the kind of thing that I'm still searching for the best way to use certain things, like a Tumblr. I'm still trying to figure out how to use that appropriately as a writer. It's hard to know if you're doing things right sometimes.
The advice that I always hear whenever I go to conferences and editors or agents are giving advice, whether it's to new writers or more established ones, about social media, it's to find which platforms work for you and which platforms you connect with and you feel natural on, and focus on those, and that you don't have to do all of them. So like, yeah, I don't know what to do with Tumblr, so I don't use it. I have a blog, but I really only post very occasionally if there's big news to share on that. And like I said, I've kind of fallen off a bit with Twitter. I used it a lot more when I was in the earlier stages of my career and making a lot of those early connections with my debut group of authors or looking for an agent or editor. And I use it less now, and whereas I've ratcheted it up with the Instagram because I feel like that's a little bit easier for me. And now with the 3 foodie books out, it's easy for me to post pictures of what I'm eating or cooking and get into conversations with people about that because they know that that's something I'm interested in. So it shifts over time, I find, you know, which ones are the best fit for me. And I just try to go with that.
Do you maintain an email newsletter?
I do.
So do you find it to be a useful marketing tool? And how often do you send it out? And what kinds of content do you include?
I send it out probably about quarterly, so maybe 4 times a year. Probably a little bit more if I have a new book coming out, because I might send one that has my tour schedule on it and another one on release day. I always send one out if I have a cover reveal, because I usually have some kind of ARC giveaway going on and I want to let my core readers know about that. I do think that it's a useful marketing tool. I used to work as a web editor for a magazine for years before I went to authoring more full time. We had a website with all this new content all the time, and we had blogs, but it was when we sent out our weekly email newsletter that really drove traffic to the site. Something about getting that newsletter in your inbox that would actually finally get people to check out the site and click through to things that interested them. I do think that it's useful as a direct way to reach out to readers. And also with my email newsletter, it's not that I have so many subscribers, but they're all either friends or readers that I've met at events who signed up for the newsletter there, and sometimes librarians who I've connected with through Skype visits or in-person visits. I find that even if it's a kind of smaller number of readers, it's a very dedicated group of people who are actually reading my books, buying my books, excited when I have a new book out or when I have news to share. If I send something out with the first set of pre-order links or something, I'm going to get a bunch of pre-orders from people who are really motivated and excited about my new project. It's a nice way to target a small core audience of the most dedicated, motivated readers and fans.
I always check my stats. I see if it's getting opened, who is reading it, what they're clicking on.
Right.
And I do have a decent open rate. It's not, of course, 100%, but people are opening it and looking to see what I have to say. Mm-hmm. I need to get better about sending it out on a schedule like you. I pretty much only send it out when I have something to share that's big, like a cover reveal or a deal announcement. Right. If one of the books is a Kindle Daily deal, I always send that out.
Yeah.
I've read over and over and over again that you should send it out monthly. I feel like that might be a little bit of overkill. What do you think?
I tend to agree. I think that if it's a rarer thing, then people are probably more likely to actually pay attention when you send something. I do subscribe to some that do come out monthly, and they're wonderful. And those authors often interview another author or spotlight other books that they're reading. And when I send mine out, it tends to be like four different items all about me.
Right,
throwing it together at the last minute, and I'm always like, oh, it would be really nice to put something in here that highlights somebody else, but then I have to wait till tomorrow to get that together, so I'm just gonna send it now and throw in some extra pictures of my last event or whatever.
I would be interested to know what the most successful email newsletters use for content, because I do feel braggy, and I'm not a braggy person, and I always feel braggy when I'm sending out that email newsletter. It's like, you know, people signed up for my information, my updates, they want to hear about me. And I'm always like, I feel braggy when I do it.
I feel that way too. But I figure if it's only going out four or five times a year, if it's rare enough, then I try not to feel too bad. But like I said, I try to save it for the big news. And I think that you do too. I get your newsletter and I don't feel inundated by it at all.
Good.
Which I think is kind of nice. So, you know, if you want to up it to monthly and involve other people, I think that's wonderful. But I also think it's okay just to kind of save it for the really big news and use it for that and not overtax your readership.
Because I have a pretty decent sized email subscription list now. I think it's over 1,000. But I always lose some when I send it out because people sign up when I do art giveaways and stuff on my blog. I have one of the entries be sign up for my email newsletter.
Yeah,
and some of them are just signing up. Yeah. And it's just like some of them are just signing up to get a chance for an arc and they drop it. But that's fine because I don't want them receiving it if they don't want it. And I know what that's like because I sign up for newsletters sometimes from, like gardening magazines and stuff like that. And then I'm getting two or three a day and I'm like, guys, I didn't ask for this.
Or political newsletters, too. I've had to unsubscribe from many. If you make like a $5 contribution to a campaign, sometimes you end up on a list where you're getting three emails a day with increasingly desperate headlines. And I can't take it.
I don't want to feel stress in my inbox.
Next, Tara's playwriting past, seeing your work performed, and where to find Tara online.
You are also a playwright.
Well, I used to be, at least. I haven't written plays in a few years at this point, but I've had some produced over the years,
I have never written a play, so you're definitely a playwright.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What skills do you find cross over from fiction to the stage, and vice versa, which ones simply don't translate?
I found that my work as a playwright has really helped me in being able to write good dialogue. Because when you're a playwright, that's really the only tool that you have. You're going to have a set designer who decides what the stage looks like. You're going to have actors who are bringing some of the nuance of the character to the piece. You're going to have a director who also decides what the whole atmosphere of the production is going to be like. And you may or may not be involved in that as the writer, depending on how many productions there are or where they're taking place. So all you have control over are the words that the actors are saying. Luckily, with the plays that I've had that have been produced, I've often been able to be part of the production and rehearsal process. So I've gotten to revise as I've listened to the actors rehearsing, you know, and I hear what sounds good and what doesn't sound right. I think that that's really helped me be strong at dialogue. I love it when I talk to students and they tell me that my books feel like they're really happening in real life or they feel realistic in some way. And I really think that comes down to the way the characters talk to each other. I think that they sound a little bit more like real kids having a conversation than people trying to get certain information across or whatever the agenda might be in that scene. Mm-hmm. I think I'm able to couch that well in real sounding back and forth. As to what skills don't cross over, writing a play and having it put on is very collaborative, and you have to let go of a lot of the details as the playwright and accept that actors are going to interpret things in a way that you didn't anticipate, or a director is going to put a different spin on things, or the set's not going to look like what you pictured in your mind. So I found that when I was writing plays, it was nice for me to be able to switch between working on plays and working on fiction, because with fiction, I had complete control of everything. But I also had the responsibility of writing everything. I had to do the description, and I had to come up with pretty much every element myself. And of course, later on, you end up collaborating with an editor, cover designer, and everything. But for many, many months or years, when you're writing a novel, it's just you and the words mm-hmm. on the page. Whereas when I'm writing a play, it's just you at the beginning, but then you know you're going to need to work with a lot of other people if that's ever going to reach an audience. Those are quite different, and depending on, you know, how social I felt like being, that might determine whether I wanted to work on a play next or kind of hunker down in my corner and write a story or a novel.
I read that your plays, at least one of them, was performed in Dublin, is that correct?
Yes,
in Ireland?
That's right.
So how did that come about?
After college, I got a scholarship to go study in Ireland for a year to study writing. I will tell you, I studied scone eating and beer drinking and traveling around Ireland a lot more than anything I actually really studied in a classroom. But it was a great experience as a young adult to be able to do that. And when I was there, I was working on plays and fiction, and I kind of just made some connections. I went to as many plays as I could, because luckily in Dublin, they were really affordable, especially for students. And I just wanted to immerse myself in the world of theater and see everything that was coming out. So I would go to the theater all the time. And I knew which companies were open to submissions. And I kept tabs, even when I moved back to the States and went to work in publishing, I kept tabs on some of the contests. And there was a contest for short plays that one company was putting on, and I sent it in. And this was back in the day when you had to print stuff out and mail it, put extra postage on it to send it overseas, rather than just emailing it in or whatever. But they chose my play to be included in this evening of, I forget how many, 13 short plays or something like that. And they paid me some money. It was great. I think it was 500 euros. At the time, the euro and the dollar were right around the same. They're pretty equivalent. But that was enough for me then to turn around, spend all that money on a plane ticket, and actually go to Ireland and see the production. Yeah, so I didn't make a big profit on that one. But it was very exciting to see one of my works produced in another country. And that was something that I wasn't involved in the production at all. So I just showed up and saw what the actors and the director had chosen to do with it, and had to say, okay, interesting, you know, and then get to sit in the audience and hear what the audience thought, which was great.
That's so cool. I can't even imagine. I think that would be pretty amazing.
It's fun when you write funny plays and then you actually hear people laugh. But then it's painful when they don't laugh, when it's a line that you think is really funny. And I don't know how people who write serious plays do it unless they like sit in the audience and watch people weeping.
I was in the plays when I was in high school. I didn't do any in college, because I went to a college that had an extremely competitive and very good theater arts program. And so I didn't even try. I came from a really small school, and I knew that, like, in my little pond, I was a big fish, but I was very aware that I was in a different pond now. But I always, whenever we were doing something humorous, it blew my mind the things that the audience would laugh at.
Right.
Because it was never what I thought was funny.
Yeah, I've been to plays, or I've been to readings of plays, where I think a line is funny and clearly no one else in the audience does. And I always try to laugh kind of extra loud in case the playwright is there, or I know the actors are listening, because I'm like, no, that was a good one. Maybe no one else is getting it, but I get it, and I'm gonna be loud about it, because I'm generally kind of a shy and retiring person. But when I'm in the audience at the theater and I have like a strong opinion about something that I think is funny, I'll just like chuckle really loudly and make sure everyone hears my reaction. It's an interesting situation to be in. And then from one performance to the next, which lines land and which lines don't can change, which is also really interesting.
That's true. I know that delivering them, it was always hard, because I would put in the pause because I'm expecting them to laugh, and nobody laughs. And I'm like, oh, man. totally made it clear that I thought you were going to laugh and you didn't laugh. So yeah, that's always embarrassing.
Yeah.
We do know that you have a social media presence of certain stripes. So tell us where our listeners can find you online.
My website is taraderman.com. So just my name. And that has links to all the other places you can find me online. I am on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can also on my website sign up for my email newsletter. You can find out about free Skype visits if you're an educator. I always keep my events page up to date so you can see where I'll be traveling this fall when my new book, The Great Hibernation, comes out. And that's my first book that's not part of the All Four Stars series. It's a standalone middle grade, and I'm very excited about it. And I have a blog on the site as well, which I update, you know, with major news.
Rider, Rider, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palombo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/Rider, Rider, Pants on Fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Rider, Rider, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.